Hello, everyone, and welcome into this episode of the Irish NFL Show with me, Colm Cronin. And I am delighted to be joined by today's guest. It is a man who was the NFL Executive of the Year in 2000. He has been the GM for both the Saints and the Dolphins, and he now co-hosts a wonderful podcast, the Football GM Podcast, with Mike Sando from The Athletic. Randy Mueller, how are you doing, sir?
I am doing great, and it's my pleasure to be with you. Love to talk football abroad, so I'm happy to be here with you.
I appreciate you taking the time, and I really do enjoy your podcast with Mike Sando. And kind of want to maybe start there, because if we go back a few years now, when the Russell Wilson trade was made, and Broncos fans like myself and many others in the media were kind of doing cartwheels about this, and the Broncos were going to be relevant again. And yourself and Mike kind of pumped the brakes a little bit and were saying, this might not be, you know, the deal that the Broncos think. They might not be getting the player that they expect. And that was very different from what everybody else was saying. What was it that kind of gave you a little bit of pause with that particular trade, Randy?
Well, for one thing, Mike and I both live in the Seattle area, and I spent 17 years with the organization myself. So all of my friends are still there kind of running the program. So I probably know too much at different times. And we had watched, and we are every day hit over the head with Seahawk news. And so they're our team. That's still my team to this day. After 35 years in the NFL, I still follow them the closest. We had seen a little trend downward, in our opinion, with Russell's ability. But even more so than that, it became kind of a branding show. It became just what it was in year one in Denver, where I'm not sure how much the football was important to him, but all the other stuff was. And so that kind of took over, really, the Seahawks organization at some point. It wasn't really about football. It was about TV shows and social media and everything else. And I'm never been for having a diva as my quarterback. And that's kind of what Russell became, was a diva. Now, it took a year of hard, you know, reality in Denver to realize that, hey, I better be able to play football or none of that other stuff matters. And so it's not surprising. In fact, I had a couple conversations with Denver people before they made the trade. And I remember thinking to myself, boy, I hope they watch the tape. I hope they really know what they're getting, because this guy wasn't doing things that I had seen him do in the past. So I guess maybe we had a little inclination, and we surely aren't beating our chest, because I've been on both sides of deals like that, maybe not to the extent of giving up what Denver gave up to get Russell, but it's hard. Building a team is hard. And I know George well. George worked for me with the Dolphins in Miami, George Payton, the GM of the Dolphins, of the Broncos. And so I kind of knew what he was getting into, wading into these Russell Wilson waters. The other thing was, not to be long-winded, I apologize, but the Broncos had swung and missed so many times on quarterbacks. You know, they had hit on Peyton Manning, but really since John Elway, that was their only hit was really Peyton Manning, and they had swung and missed through the draft. They had not drafted players. They drafted Bradley Chubb the year that Josh Allen came out, and I remember sitting in the press box at a game late in that season with John Elway, who was running their team, and saying to myself when I left, this is watching Josh Allen in his final game at Wyoming, thinking, gosh, he's got the Broncos written all over him. This is a perfect fit. And they ended up drafting, like I say, Bradley Chubb, and went a different direction. And that kind of made me shake my head as well. So long-winded answer, long winding road, kind of knew what Russell Wilson was all about. And unfortunately for Bronco fans, it's been kind of a slippery slope ever since he arrived.
Yeah, and just maybe following on a little bit from that, because, you know, as you said, you know George. And in terms of, you know, it hasn't really worked out for him in Denver, Randy. And I'm just wondering, like, you know, there was the Hackett came in. We'll probably at some point in the future get the full story on that. but that didn't work out. Like, he doesn't even last the season. Wilson, it looks like we're, you know, the Broncos are on the verge of taking the largest dead cap hit in league history. Randy Gregory didn't work out. Frank Clark didn't work out. The Mike McGlinchey deal doesn't look a great one. He had a solid first draft, but drafts 2 and 3. I mean, look, it's very early in the process. Maybe they can turn around. But are you surprised that things really have? I mean, this is a guy who came in a lot of fanfare, but ultimately the Broncos haven't had a winning season while he's been there.
Yeah, it's been a tough road for them. There's no doubt. Would I say I'm surprised? I'm surprised that they haven't really got it together at all. Now, George came up, and when he was with me and with the Vikings, was primarily on the pro scouting side. He was not a college scout. He didn't spend a lot of time really messing around in the draft. That just wasn't his area of expertise, but those skills can be acquired as well. I think probably we're all surprised that they didn't have more success, but hey, they've made some questionable hires. There's no doubt. And that's a hard thing. I think George really probably, if he gave him some truth serum, would say, hey, I probably wished I would have had a go-to evaluator that I really knew and trusted alongside that I could bounce things off of. I don't know that he's had that during his time in Denver. A lot of the young guys, and I don't consider George young or inexperienced, but a lot of these young GMs, they get these jobs now, they bring with them an older, more experienced set of eyes who can be your trusted evaluator per se. And some of these guys come to me still and ask me, what should I do? That's really the first thing I tell them to hire is somebody like that. Because when you become GM, like George did, or like some Adam Peters this year with the Commanders, or any of these other guys, your days of sitting in a room watching tape, they disappear fast because you're managing people. There's a lot more to these jobs than just picking players in a closet. And that's really what gets these GMs in their first stint, is they just don't have time to do that. And really, they've got to lean on others to give the evaluations, to tell them the rights and wrongs and the right turn versus left turn. And those that don't have that experience or that perspective around them seldom get a chance to recalibrate, like maybe George is getting in year three, get a little recalibration, and they're gone before they get a chance to get it right the second time around. So it's a tough job, there's no doubt. And then you go through an ownership change like George did. That's never fun either. I've been through that 2 or 3 times, and that can upset the apple cart of continuity as well.
Maybe like on the big QB trades that we've seen recently with Wilson, with Rodgers, and with Watson, safe to say none of those have really worked out. I'm wondering from your perspective, having been a GM, do you think that might give teams pause in the future for making those sorts of deals? Or are we dealing with, you know, NFL teams and GMs, there's always going to be a bit of ego and I can make it work. I'm going to pull the trigger on this. Or does 3 of them not working out today give teams pause?
I think, and I'll just leave it at this, some evaluate quarterbacks better than others. I'm going to be honest with you. Not everybody can do it. Look at Matthew Stafford, how that deal has worked out for the Rams. And that tells me Sean McVay kind of gets it. That was one that I had no doubt that was going to work. I couldn't tell you they're going to win the Super Bowl, but I knew Matthew Stafford would be a great fit in that system. So it happens where you can get an established quarterback somewhere. But I think sometimes teams are so desperate to fill that chair with somebody that can excite the fan base and excite the media that they just don't do their homework, or they do it incorrectly. And that's the bottom line, is that some people are better evaluating quarterbacks than others. I think this draft will be a great example of that. There are 4 or 5 names in this first round this year that are being tossed around as franchise-saving quarterbacks. This happened a couple years ago as well, when everybody said, oh, there's 4 or 5 guys, we're going to run them off, all the way down to Mac Jones, who went last to the Patriots. Well, look back now and see how many of those guys have worked out. This draft is the same. I have a hunch that there's 1, maybe 2 guys in this first round that are out of the 5 or 6 names I hear the experts talking about that might be that I'd be willing to line up behind. There's two or three that I don't know, man. I don't know if I see that. And I'm not saying I know best. I'm just saying there are reasons why these guys make it, and there are reasons why they fail. A lot of times it's the organization as a whole that makes successes or failures. But when you talk about quarterbacks and skill sets, not many people, and I'm saying this after 35 years in the league, not many people in my mind can identify and evaluate the skill sets that are needed to be good at the NFL level. And I'll just leave it at that.
Well, one of the guys in this draft who, you know, you were certainly a little bit ahead of the posse, right? Because there's been all this buzz about JJ McCarthy within the last couple of weeks. But I was listening to you on the Football GM podcast back in late December, early January. And you were saying that you thought JJ was, you had him higher than and you felt people in the league would have him higher than he other people were ranking him at that point. Can you talk to me a little bit about that and what you saw that led you to kind of evaluate him and think that the league will, and we're beginning to see that, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think, not that I'm right, I'm just saying the league is, as I thought they would catch on. A lot of times it's once quarterback coaches and head coaches can have time to spend researching and watching and observing. These quarterbacks rise late because of that. I think in his case, and talk about JJ McCarthy from Michigan, in his case, it's not a project for entry-level scouts. It's not a project for those who don't have a lot of experience at pulling out some of these traits that I think are evident in JJ McCarthy. Now, in getting ready for our visit today, I did go back and listen to your podcast the other day when you guys were talking about a chance of a union between Sean Payton and JJ McCarthy. And in fact, The Athletic had a mock draft today with their writers, their beat writers from each team. And I forget who has the Denver case. They made a trade to go up, I think, to 8 or 9 to get JJ McCarthy. When I see these things, it makes me smile because I would be in line behind that. If you're going to tell me that Sean Payton can team up with JJ McCarthy, I'm signing up. I think that's going to be a great follow. And I can understand, because I do think Sean is one of those guys that gets it. He can evaluate. He knows how to identify the skills that are important. I think the reason that he's been a little bit of an enigma, McCarthy, is that at Michigan, they played kind of an old school offensive system, not asked him to do a lot. They want to run the ball. I get all that stuff. But he showed me some things that made me say, wow. And I don't think everybody saw that. I think they will in time. He's not 21 yet. He can't even go have a beer yet. That's how young he is. The development outside the Michigan scheme will make him, I think, better as well. He's just one of those kids that I think is going to be a better pro than he was a college player. And I think you're going to have to get in the top 10 at the end of the day to get him. You may have to even go up quite a bit higher than that by the time everybody gets done dissecting all these other quarterbacks.
And just touching maybe on the Michigan piece, because obviously Harbaugh has gone to the Chargers, who are an organization that you know quite well. One of the things that kind of strikes me, and I know you've talked about the Chargers, but one of the things that strikes me about this is I can see this working well for Herbert, because Harbaugh is going to take up, you know, he's going to be the star. He's going to be the front man. And it appears from the outside, I mean, I'm very far away, but it appears that Justin Herbert doesn't want that aspect of it. So having a coach in Harbaugh who will do that, in contrast to, say, Staley, who never really felt, you know, was that larger-than-life character, am I right in my thinking that that might be a good thing for Herbert?
I think it's an awesome thing for Herbert. I think it's an awesome thing for the Chargers, because I think Jim Harbaugh, his personality, his persona, is exactly what the Chargers needed. The Chargers, and those listeners who don't know, I spent 10 years there. The last 10 years I was in the NFL, I spent with the Chargers. And my dilemma with that all along was that I never thought anybody was demanding and accountable of any of our actions. And I think Jim Harbaugh is just the kind of guy that will be. I think he will hold everybody to a higher standard. I don't think he'll allow mediocrity. I think with regard to Herbert specifically, the fact that Harbaugh will identify with this team as being a little more blue collar, a little more hard nose, a little more let's run the ball, that's only going to help Herbert. Greg Roman, the offensive coordinator, first and foremost, wants to run the ball as well. So I do think maybe Herbert's numbers won't be what they've been in the past, but if they can find a way to run the ball and strengthen themselves on the defensive side to stop the run, that'll make a lot more successful wins and losses. So I think indirectly, Harbaugh is going to be good for business, and he's going to be directly good for Justin Herbert. And you're right. I just don't see Herbert's personality as being that guy that wants to shoulder the load, or at least publicly, he would rather take a step back. And your assessment is correct. Not that Jim is seeking attention, but that's just his personality. People are going to get in line behind him, and very few are going to doubt it, because he may run over you if you're not, you know, picking up the slack in your own way.
Now, Randy, you are not one to blow your own trumpet, but I'm going to do it for you. I've talked about JJ, I've talked about Russell Wilson, but one of the things I noticed as well was back when the Cowboys were on the run in October, November, you were banging the table for them to give Dak the extension, because you knew what was going to happen. You knew how this ends, and here we are now, another disappointing end to the season. They go in to this offseason with a head coach who's in the final year of his contract, and Dak in the final year of his. Dak also has a no trade clause and a no tag clause. So in theory, if they don't give Dak a contract that he's happy with, he could hit free agency in a move, you know, in a way that we haven't really seen previously, a player of his age. How did the Cowboys get themselves into this position?
Well, I don't know. That's a good question. Jerry Jones is supposed to be the great businessman of all time, right? I think, as we all know, and as we all get a little long in the tooth, we all understand that negotiations are usually about timing. And I always have been one to want to make a strike when the timing's best for me, and not when it's best for you, if you're on the other side. And Dak, the longer it goes, more leverage than ever. You're right. Everything you've pointed out is true. And as we get closer to free agency, it just falls more and more in line with Dak having control of the whole situation. I know this, and just using my own experience, the worst deals I've ever made were the ones that I had no options on and had to make. And so I just don't know what the Cowboys could do. They're going to have to pay him. My thought was pay him halfway through this year when it looked like things were going to head north and he had played really good, and do it sooner than later. And maybe they just couldn't do it. Maybe the agent, Todd France, at the same time wasn't ready to pull the trigger, because he knew that eventually he would have more leverage. It's going to be fascinating to see how it kind of plays out. I don't know. Could Dak hit the open market? If he does, he's going to be the highest paid player in the league, regardless if he's with the Cowboys or hits free agency. So he's going to get his money regardless.
And obviously in relation to Mike McCarthy, and, you know, a lot of talk, I know you thought you can see it making some sense bringing him back, but can I play devil's advocate a little bit? Because to me, it isn't just the playoff losses, though I do think that's a factor, but it's the way in which the Bills were able to run all over them. It's the fact that they let the Lions back into that game where they could have if the two-point conversion had come off. And then it's obviously the playoffs. And to me, I suppose, I'm just surprised that nobody, it feels like nobody out there was really talking about, because I suppose I have the experience with the Broncos of John Fox, and very successful in the regular season, but ultimately in the playoffs, couldn't get it done. The Broncos chose to move on. Gary Kubiak came in, and well, it worked out in a different sort of way. But is there, like, is it, it, should that ever be a model for people to look at the way in which the Broncos kind of, because they were so successful, and John Fox had great success with Peyton Manning, the best regular season offense that we had seen, but they always fell in the playoffs, and they made the decision to move on, and it proved successful. Was that just a fluke? Is that the reason that the teams seem reluctant to move on from coaches who are successful in the regular season?
Well, I think in Mike's case, he won a Super Bowl in Green Bay, so he has had success in the playoffs. The setup in Dallas is very unique. It's different than the other 31 teams. No other team in the NFL owner has a press conference at the end of each Sunday across the aisle from where the head coach is having his press conference. Nobody runs business like that. So it is unique. It is different. The structure is different. The messenger is a different person. And let's face it, the buck stops with the owner there. And I think at the end of the day, and I agreed with them keeping Mike, but I think at the end of the day, Jerry Jones would have had to admit that he made a mistake with Mike if he fires him. So I think he's always had a long rope with his coaches. I mean, look at Jason Garrett. Yeah, Jason Garrett. I mean, people had him fired 3 or 4 years before he got fired. Jerry does not like to admit mistakes. And you see that with his players. There are players that they've rewarded with contracts that make me shake my head. I would say no way is that guy worth that kind of money. Jerry's always been wanting to anoint the decisions that he's made. And I think that is another example of it by keeping McCarthy. He wants to make himself right. Time will tell if it does. I think there are a lot of reasons the Cowboys didn't make it, of which I don't think McCarthy was the prime one. So we'll see if it works out with different defensive coordinator. And let's just face it, they've got to change some things in the way they acquire players as well. So the team building component is always different in Dallas for sure.
And again, drawing on your experience as GM, like if we look at, say, the Buffalo Bills and where they're at, because obviously, you know, they've kind of riddled with injuries on defense last year, but going into this offseason, they're significantly over the cap. Like that's, you know, you can adjust that. But there's, I suppose, in Diggs, they have a player who, you know, seems to have been unhappy for more than a year now. And they gave a huge deal to Von Miller, which, you know, Von, superstar at one point, you know, was a key component of the Broncos winning, a key component of the Rams winning. But last year kind of looked at a shadow of himself. But there's no real way out of that contract. What does one do as a GM? Because with Diggs, they can't really move on from him either, given the dead cap hit that they would have to take. So how do you look to kind of, I suppose, manage that situation with an unhappy player and with an aging star who you've given huge money to, who maybe isn't contributing in the way that you had hoped?
Yeah, well, I don't know that there's a chapter in the GM book for that. I think those are decisions that we make that we lose sleep over. They've made some of those in Buffalo in trying to surround Josh Allen with the best talent they could. The character part of it is, in my opinion, the hardest thing to read. I don't think when they signed Diggs, they thought he would be a problem per se. And it seems like there's always been something that's bothered him for the last year or so. That's an issue. The Von Miller deal for me was shocking in that, and you know it from Denver, Von Miller has never been one the last 4 or 5 years to be engaged and counted on for 17 weeks. He's always picked his spots. Even the year they won the Super Bowl with the Rams, he picked his spots. So that's just the way it is. So you kind of sell your soul as a GM to what these guys are willing to do after they get paid. And that's a hard one because you're right. You can't get out from underneath these massive guarantees. So they're going to have to grit and bear it, and they're going to have to find a way to make it work. Unfortunately for Buffalo, they've got some other free agents that they're going to have to deal with, whether it's, you know, Gabe Davis or Leonard Floyd or, you know, they've got some guys that they have to look at, that Daquan Jones. I mean, these guys are all really good players, and they're going to have to pay these guys. Otherwise, their team is, you know, on the edge of crumbling. So I don't know that I have an answer for it. It's a hard job, but it's a reason to be more reluctant to give away money. And I say give away, especially big money, to players above 30, receivers that are mercurial in character and personality. There's no easy way to get out from underneath it. So they're going to just have to live with it.
And on the team building aspect of being a GM, I'm just curious because say with Vaughn, it felt like Vaughn's best years came when DeMarcus Ware was there, and DeMarcus Ware was almost like an older brother who was kind of guiding him. And you see that with others in terms of the chemistry that exists with, between players. How much does that factor, you know, in just into, does that factor significantly? Does it factor at all? Is that a happy coincidence, Randy, when teams are making these sorts of roster building decisions?
Well, I think it definitely factors in. Team building is much different than collecting talent. So you're only as good as the other defensive end in that case, or the defense schemes you to be, for sure. So it's hard. Again, it seems like I'm answering a lot of your questions with the same theory that it's hard, which it is. But building these teams, there are so many components that have to come together, and winning is the last thing. Spending money does not equate to being successful. So if you think you can buy players and you're going to win games, history shows that's not the case. So eventually you're going to have to draft players, you're going to have to develop players, and they're going to have a camaraderie together and kind of police each other, if you know what I'm saying. They have to keep each other in line as a locker room, and that's the best way, I think, to build a team at the end of the day. You can supplant some of that with an occasional veteran here or there, but you've got to be really selective in the kind of players you bring in there. And they've got to share the same integrity and the same calendar of winning and that the decision makers have. So there's a trust factor that goes along with it.
And yeah, you're right. I mean, like it is really hard. Do you think it has become more difficult given the fact that, you know, the league is so big now, it's global. There are so many kind of like 24/7 news media cycles. We live in an age where hot takes get, you know, are out there, and there's talk all the time. Is it harder now, or is it just different from where it was 20, 30, 40 years ago, Randy, do you think?
I don't know that it's harder. It's definitely different. You do have more balls in the air. You have to manage more differently, I should say, if that makes any sense. I think the biggest thing for me that is missing with a lot of these team builders is the communication. I think the criteria for what their scheme and their coach and them, their vision, how all that comes together doesn't happen in a consistent way. And therefore, they're plugging holes with talent as opposed to plugging holes that are best in their system. And it's not about us getting the best players. It's about getting the best players for us. And sometimes that's an exercise that I think a lot of GMs nowadays swing and miss at. They're looking to collect talent and not necessarily gain the right guys for our scheme and our system, say like a Bill Belichick did for years. I think that series of events where you can team build with guys who fit for us may not be the right guys for the next team, but you got to be okay with letting some of those guys go. And sometimes now the media puts so much pressure on you to sign those guys or to have those guys that you're not disciplined enough to stick to your own criteria of team building. That's where teams get sideways, or the pressure of winning takes you to fill a need, which the need then is really greater than the fit. And so it just, a lot of teams get away from the fit of players when they go to team build.
I'm kind of conscious of your time. You have been very generous. I'm interested in your take as somebody who's been involved in the league. Obviously, from a fan perspective over here, delighted with the international growth of the game, and we're seeing, you know, games in more and more locations. I think it's a matter of time before we get a game in Dublin. I think we'll see games in Paris. You know, for fans over here, it's fantastic. I think the owners obviously like it because it's opening new markets. We see, you know, the international marketing agreements. From a GM perspective, from a coach perspective, from a player perspective, how did they feel about, you know, playing games kind of internationally? Because, you know, there's talk, I suppose, about like, you know, okay, if you're flying from Seattle to Florida, that's a long flight, but mentally, you're still in the same country. It's very different from crossing the Atlantic and playing in Germany. Do you think it's still a big factor for on the playing side, or are players at this point kind of more accustomed to it?
Well, I think it's grown on everybody, from players to coaches to front office people. I remember we brought the first regular season game to London when I was the GM of the Dolphins and Nick Saban was the coach. Actually, that's not true. Cam Cameron was the coach, so it was my third year there. We went and played the Giants in Wembley Stadium, and that was the first regular season game ever over there. Since then, it's come a long ways. I think the advances that teams have made in travel, the advances of how these cities have taken to the needs of these teams and made it an easy transition. And we saw this year, Jacksonville, for the first time, spend more than 1 week over there. And it was a great advantage to them because they had rested and were there for 2 weeks. And so each time the league does something like this, now the game's going to be in Brazil. I think it's great for the game. And I think the players realize it as well. I think anytime you can grow the pot of revenue, players understand that because that's reflected in the salary cap. So any of these revenues that can be done and expanded overseas, I think are going to be a bigger part of the game. I think where we're headed is eventually every team is going to play a game a year over in Europe or somewhere like that, somewhere else. And I think that's the goal. And I think it's awesome. I've often said my dream job was to run a team, the first team that goes to Europe, that goes to London, that goes to wherever. I would love to live over there and be able to run one of these teams in that environment because I think it would be so exciting. It would be groundbreaking. Some of these teams, the fan base, it would be awesome. And I just think it'd be a great experience to be in charge of a team to become England's team or London's team or Dublin's team, whatever it is. So I think it's going to happen at some point. If you can think about it in terms of this, and I don't always say Jacksonville because Jacksonville is a small market team in the U.S. Not a lot of Fortune 500 companies hanging around Jacksonville, Florida. If you could turn a team like that with a economic restrictions into a London team or another big city team, your revenues are going to quadruple, right? And that's good for everybody per se. I think it's good for the game as well, anytime you can grow it. So I think it's a matter of time. I love the concept. And I think everybody says, well, logistically, it just wouldn't work. I think it would work. You mentioned Seattle to Florida. It's a 5-hour flight. Just send Seattle to Europe and play two games, you know, or one on the East Coast and then over to Europe for the next week, something like that. So teams will deal with it. Teams will end up getting buys on the back end like they're doing. Maybe they'll get buys on the front end. There's ways to schedule these things and work around it. Frankly, I hope it happens in my lifetime because I would love to see it. I think it would be awesome.
Randy, I cannot thank you enough for taking the time to chat to me today. For anyone who is watching or listening, I would 100% advocate checking out the Football GM podcast. Comes out every Saturday with Randy and Mike Sando. You can also check out Randy's work in The Athletic. And right now, he just in the past couple of days had his list of the top free agents, which is well worth checking out as we head into free agency. And we're just the window for franchise tag is going to open, so we're going to get kind of a more of an insight into who is going to be available in March. I just want to thank you, Randy, and wish you continued success.
My pleasure. It's great to be with you. Let's do it again.
Thank you for listening. And if you're enjoying the show, please do vote with your fingers and rate, review, or subscribe on whatever podcast platform you're listening on. Every click, every like, every positive review, and every additional subscriber makes a huge difference. It helps others to find the show, and we really do appreciate it. We'd also love to hear from you and to interact with NFL fans on our social channels, wherever you're listening in the world, so please do get in touch.